Spotlight. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. On Wednesday, a terror attack on a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Shiraz left over a dozen people dead. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility, and on Friday, Iranians from all walks of life held rallies to condemn the attack. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of this terrorist attack that happened amid the riots that have recently engulfed the country. But first, let's watch this report.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. And from London, journalist and political commentator Hafsa Kara Mustafa. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. I want to get your perspective on the recent terrorist attack at the Holy Shrine in Shiraz and also how you perceive the message of today's rallies.
Thank you for having me.
In every act of terrorism or every crime, the first question is cui bono, so who benefit from the act of terrorism or from the crime. Now, we've been following ISIS since a very long time in Iraq and in Syria and in Lebanon, and we understand that this group has been almost defeated because you can't end the ideology of Takfiri Wahhabism, but you can put an end to the strength and the power of the group. Therefore, we see in the terrorist attack in Shiraz, there is no benefit really for ISIS to go and attack a place worshipped by the population and to get a slim result of 15 killed just for people to talk about ISIS that is almost dead. So we understand that is a clear message to Iran for several reasons. First, because the JCPOA is frozen. Second, because there are many news that Iran is supporting Russia and the war in Ukraine, and its drones are highly damaging to the objective of the U.S. to defeat Russia. And third, because the Iranians are not willing to submit to the U.S. will to sign a quick deal and to make available the energy that Iran has in gas and oil to the most needed European and American market. So inevitably, we understand also that the Israelis and the CIA have been very active in Iran by acts of sabotage and assassination of nuclear scientists, the sabotage on nuclear location and in other location belonging to the Iranian government. And the last point is it comes in a time where there are riots in Iran caused by always the same objective to change the regime. So all this combination, we understand that this terrorist attack falls into the same bouquet that the West is trying to promote unrest in Iran to defeat the economy that is trying to pick up, regardless the endless and the thousands of sanctions, and also to put in doubt the security in Iran. That is the main message that we understand from this terrorist attack.
Hafsakara Mustafa, what do you think was the purpose of the attack at this point in time, and why was a holy shrine the target of such an attack?
It's not remotely surprising because, of course, this is a target of a Sunni extremist group targeting a place that is sacred to Shia. So it's very much in line with what the kind of ISIS objective would be in any situation at any other time. But I think at this particular moment, it's a way of trying to hit Iran when it is perceived that Iran is weakened by these riots that are continuing and that are being fueled, obviously, by exterior forces. So it's a way of adding an extra layer of attacks on Iran at a time where it needs to come together and actually resist any form of external pressure. And so ISIS, as has been the case since it came into being, whether it being in Syria or in Iraq, every time a country comes together in order to fight external forces, ISIS comes in and does the dirty work for the imperialist powers. So this particular moment in time is not remotely surprising. And I would, of course, agree completely with my fellow panelists saying that it's a time when Russia and Iran are collaborating together and showing a stronger front against this sort of coalition of Western powers that are looking to weaken Iran, but Iran simply isn't signing up to this and continues to do business, refusing to submit to the pressures of Western governments, and has shown that it's still staying strong. And so we're probably going to see further attacks similar to these, I'm afraid to say, in order to show that Iran is going to be attacked over and over again until it accepts. But I think, as we've seen in the past, although they have tried it with ISIS, whether in Syria or in Iraq, I'm not sure it's going to work nevertheless.
I'm going to stay with you, Ms. Kara Mustafa. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, spoke about the Shiraz attack, calling for unity among the nation and also for efforts to dig deep into the origins of such crimes. Can you walk us through his recent comments, please?
course, and this makes absolute sense because, as I said, this is a moment where Iran is being targeted from various places, and I think it's very important for the people of Iran to come together and fully realize that these attacks and these attempts to weaken Iran, whether through terrorist attacks or whether in fueling these unnecessary riots that are absolutely benefiting no one. I mean, it's one thing to make a political point and to attempt to force new change. That's a legitimate form of legitimate forms of protest, but what is happening now are riots that are bringing that are weakening the country, that are also diverting police forces away from where it is needed, such as attacks that we've seen in Shiraz. And therefore, the Supreme Leader is right. The Iranian people really need to come together at this point and actually put aside all their political differences in order to push away all these external forces that are targeting the regime, but actually, in effect, they will be targeting and weakening the entire nation of Iran, and all people will suffer, irrespective of their political colors.
Mr. Magni, do you agree with our guest in London? On that note, the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, said the recent events in Iran had paved the way for this attack on the Shah Cheragh Shrine in Shiraz to happen. What's your take on that?
I do agree with what President Raisi said, because the riots in Iran that have been supported largely by mainstream media is giving the false impression that the whole of Iran is moving against the institution, which is not right. So this movement is giving away the possibility of other acts of sabotage and terrorism. It is not again between Shia and Sunni like they try to portray it by ISIS claiming its responsibility, because this card has been used and overused in Iraq and didn't work, and in Syria and even there it didn't work, and in Lebanon and it has failed, and now in Iran and it will not succeed. So saying that this is the act of foreign forces is because the presence in the street and the riots to destroy institutions, to burn ambulances, and to create a havoc in the country, giving the image that Iran, there is no stability and security in Iran, helps for more act of sabotage and more attacks, inevitably, because Iran refused to be submitted to the United States will and to the dictate of the American dominance, particularly in the Middle East. As your guest rightly said, which I fully agree, we're going to see more of that in the future.
Ms. Kara Mustafa, Iran says that it's in possession of, quote, irrefutable documents proving that the U.S. was the chief architect of the recent riots in the country. Now, in a joint statement that was issued earlier, Iran's intelligence ministry and the IRGC also said that some foreign spy agencies, namely the Israelis and the Saudis, were involved as well. What are the motives of such efforts?
Well, again, I mean, it's to weaken Iran at a time when Iran's resources are badly needed and when it's necessary. I mean, Iran has been a target by Western forces since the 1979 revolution, so there's nothing surprising in that. And we see these sort of riots erupting and Western media supporting any form of rioting almost every other year now. So there's nothing new. But I think in this particular instance, in the climate of the war between Russia and Ukraine, I think it's particularly sensitive because the cost of living crisis in Europe is starting to bite. You know, energy prices are very expensive. And so Western economies are desperate to find cheaper energy. And the best way to find cheaper energy is to make sure that the country that produces these resources are actually weakened so that they don't have a greater say on the negotiating table. The weaker they are, the better, and the more pliant they will be, and they're more likely to accept the conditions imposed on them by the buyer as opposed to them being the seller. So this is very a straightforward logic of imperialist politics towards Iran. It has been the same for 40 years, but it seems to be now even more pressing, given that Iran produces not only oil, but especially gas, at a time where gas is very, very precious. And I think this is a way putting pressure on Iran for it to sell at the conditions that are advantageous to the buyers now.
Mr. Magnier, the recent statement by Iran alludes to evidence showing the U.S. having an active role in orchestrating riots in Iran. It said the ultimate aim of the plot was to, quote, commit crimes against the Iranian nation, violate Iran's territorial integrity, and pave the ground for further foreign pressure against the country. What is to be achieved through such measures? What are the perpetrators aiming for?
Well, the first sanctions were imposed by President Jimmy Carter in 1979, and since we've seen how every single U.S. president imposed further sanctions on Iran. And if we look at what President Donald Trump, we've got the answer to your question, is to impose maximum pressure on Iran for Iran to accept the conditions imposed by the United States. And the deal was signed, the U.S. president rejected it in 2018, violating international laws. And the Americans don't care. They just want the Iranian to offer, first, no more threat to Israel, second, to pull out the support to the oppressed population around the world, particularly in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Venezuela, in Yemen. And they want Iran to be completely passive, and then they are ready to deal with the Iranian government, whoever is in control. So this is the request of Iran to submit to what the Americans want. This is why this is going to happen and happen again. And this is what the Americans want from the Iranian. Submit, and then you can live. However, we see all these thousands of sanctions imposed on the Iranians. They have the objective to push the population to rise against their leaders. They are sanctions that cause the suffering of the Iranian people more than the Iranian leaders. And this is where the American sanctions always hit, and hit hard. But so far, Iran has managed to reject that and to stand against it and to make sure that this is not really crippling its economy. And it has been managing so far. This is upsetting the Americans, who would like to see Iran on its knee, would like to see no collaboration with the Russian, would like to see a cut of Iranian relationship with Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen, and certainly Venezuela in the American backyard. But it's not going to happen. Iran continuing its policy, and the Americans will try more sabotage on Iranian territory.
Ms. Kara Mustafa, an analyst that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV, believes that such meddlesome U.S. policies will once again fail in Iran. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, but I mean, I'm slightly pessimistic in that it's going to succeed to some extent before it inevitably fails. They're going to continue to apply pressure. They're going to continue to cause unrest and problems for Iran, sadly. And as my fellow panelists said, in effect impacting far more the people of Iran more than the leaderships. But I think on the long run, it will inevitably fail, as it always has. I mean, it's failed for the past 40 years. And their policies in general, in fact, have failed pretty much everywhere. There is nothing to have benefited from any of the Middle Eastern policies that they've applied anywhere in the region or beyond. I mean, we've seen them last year leaving with their tails between their legs from Afghanistan, despite an extraordinarily superior military force. So we know that the long-term policies of America never succeed, but sadly, in the short term, they do impact greatly the population. And I think this is why perhaps the Supreme Leader's words are very important and need to be echoed to the people who are currently rioting, which is to say that actually, if you're rioting, you're not really benefiting your country. You're essentially benefiting those who want to weaken your country.
Elijah Magnier, what are the broader repercussions of instability and insecurity in Iran for the region and probably for beyond that?
They are huge, because Iran has been supporting Syria from preventing it from becoming a failed state. They've been supporting Iraq. We remember since 2014, General Qasem Soleimani prevented Iraq from falling when the Americans didn't do anything. And we see also the support of Iran in Yemen by preventing the fall of Yemen in the hand of the Israelis and Bab al-Mandeb, that is a very important maritime crossing under the full control of the Americans, and the fall of the population under the control of the Saudis that have been waging a destructive war on the Yemeni. So we see that the countries in the Middle East will be without a very important supporter that is creating a balance between the dozens of the U.S. military bases in the Middle East and West Asia, and the power of Iran that has been growing in the last decades to the point that it has today a drone and missile and can defend itself and also can transmit the support to other population, particularly in Palestine, where people, the Palestinian people, have realized that they're still holding to their cause, because all the other countries in the Middle East gave up on them, most of them, but not all, but most of them, and Iran continued to support the Palestinian cause and transfer the experience and the military experience to them and the technology they need to continue their struggle to recover their territory. So but the fall of Iran, of seeing Iran under stress and more or less prevented from keeping this balance, is going to be devastating for the Middle East.
And one last question before we wrap up the program, Ms. Kara Mustafa, very briefly, if you may. This terrorist attack on the Iranian shrine has drawn widespread international condemnation, but there was a delayed and even muted reaction by some Western nations. How do you assess that?
Again, it's the infamous double standards, whereby it's almost a proof that they've approved these attacks, because, of course, normally and under any circumstance, and irrespective of the government, whether you're friendly or not, normally governments do always condemn an act of terror that targets civilians. And the delayed reaction almost confirms that, A, they almost approve it, and B, they could almost be accused of somehow being associated with it. I mean, normally terrorism targeting civilians is condemned irrespectively, and yet here, as you say, the muted response is very alarming and probably shows that there is some sort of, at the very least, approval of this criminal action.
Very well. Thanks to my guest, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels, and journalist and political commentator Ms. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, joining us from the British capital, London. Good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وإذا مرضت فهو يشفين.
And when I am ill, it is he who cures me.
والذي يميتني ثم يحيين.
And who will cause me to die and then bring me to life.
والذي أطمع أن يغفر لي خطيئتي يوم الدين.
And who I aspire that he will forgive me my sin on the day of recompense.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, you already know we were discussing about these verses of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. Prophet Abraham was describing his Lord of the Worlds to these idolaters. الَّذِي خَلَقَنِي فَهُوَ يَهْدِينَ وَالَّذِي هُوَ يُطْعِمُنِي وَيَسْقِينَ وَإِذَا مَرِضْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ وَالَّذِي يُمِيتُنِي ثُمَّ يُحْيِينَ. Who created me and himself guides me, and he himself feeds me and provides me to drink, and whenever I'm sick, he heals me. وَالَّذِي يُمِيتُنِي ثُمَّ يُحْيِينَ. And who caused me to die, then gives me life. So, Prophet Abraham goes further and beyond the stage of life of this world. In continuation of his description of the Lord of the Worlds, he pays attention to eternal life and hereafter, in order to make clear that not only he enjoys favors and mercies and blessings from the Lord of the World in this present world, but also in the next world, and in all conditions, he sits at the table of his bounties, and we all do. So he says about him, وَالَّذِي يُمِيتُنِي ثُمَّ يُحْيِينَ, and who caused me to die, then gives me life. So with this, Prophet Abraham indicates that both his death and his returning to life again, they are all from his origin. And the fact, of course, that is implied is that death is not the end, because we are given life afterwards. يُمِيتُنِي ثُمَّ يُحْيِينَ. He causes me to die, and then he gives me life.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أيها الناس وأنتم
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
وَالَّذِي أَطْمَعُ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَتِي يَوْمَ الدِّينِ. Prophet Abraham mentioned this aspect of his Lord, that the death and returning to life afterwards are from his origin, and then he implies that when he arrives at the scene of gathering place of resurrection, this prophet is fixing his hope only on him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, of whom we all seek forgiveness. So the verse says, وَالَّذِي أَطْمَعُ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَةِ يَوْمَ الدِّينِ. You know what kind of Lord I'm discussing? You know what kind of Lord of the worlds I'm talking about? Who I hope will forgive me my mistakes on the day of judgment. Whatever you are worshipping, he implies, this is not the ability of him. He cannot do this for you. These things that you with your hands are creating, these things that do not hear you, nor they speak to you, they cannot be having these kinds of descriptions I mentioned for my Lord. There is no doubt that the prophets are sinless. They have no faults to be forgiven for. But as we have said previously and many times, sometimes the good deeds of the righteous are counted as the faults of the near stationed ones. And therefore, in their high rank, one good act is sometimes questionable against them too, because it has hindered the accomplishment of a better action. And thus, this is called leaving the better. So, that is one probable reason why Prophet Abraham says, وَالَّذِي أَطْمَعُ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَتِي. He is the one on whom I rely for forgiving my mistakes on the day of judgment. So he is never relying on his own good deeds, and he is always aware of the fact that he is forever in need of the Lord of the world, and he will ever be. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized the U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. Hezbollah leaders said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in a statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns.
Confidence could deteriorate further, and supply-side constraints could worsen again. Energy and food costs could also remain persistently higher than expected.
Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared.
The Commission and the EES are obviously constantly working in the context of the sanctions on making sure that we are ready should there be a need for further sanctions.
Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals. This as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S. and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favor, 79 against, and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Ma la nostra priorità. Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty, an initiative the Sana'a government says is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strength, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally, as the Ansar Allah movement has made it very clear it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth.
What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All
the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be asking a very interesting and thought-provoking question. And this question is concerned with a topic under the general heading of Islamic medicine. You know, Islam is one of those religions that is very comprehensive. It has rules regarding every single detail of life. You know, and that's because we consider the actions, the words, and even the silence of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his successors, the Imams alayhi wasallam, to be a hujjat and to be binding upon us. And they were normal people, right? You were human beings, you know, and you know, as human beings, they lived normal lives like human beings, and so they were dealing with normal problems of human beings, and you know, they encounter problems that we encounter, and you know, their responses to these, you know, events in their lives, you know, can serve as models for us. One of those, you know, events is, you know, the phenomenon of getting ill and, you know, seeking a remedy for it, and you know, so this, you know leads to the birth of Islamic medicine. And, you know, this is a very vast topic. You know, in the past, you know, it was more, unfortunately, today, in current times, it has, its importance has waned in the face of, you know, modern medicine. But, you know, in the past, it was a very elaborate and very detailed subject. The question that we want to ask today is this: whether there was something in the era of the Imams alayhi wasalam or the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam called surgery, and if there was, what was the opinion of these people, the Imams or the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam, regarding this topic? Now, before we get to the main answer regarding this, we can say that the Imams and the Prophet, they were not opposed to referring to a physician or a doctor in order to seek a cure for one's ailment. In fact, they even gave permission to their followers to refer to non-Muslim doctors for, you know, for treating their ailments and their ills. For example, Imam Bakr alayhi salam was once asked if it was permissible to refer to a Christian or a Jewish physician or doctor. And they gave permission, you know, to their followers to do so, and said that there's no problem in this because, you know, the physician or the doctor is simply a means. The actual cure and remedy is in the hands of God. A similar hadith has been related from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding the same topic, and it's a very similar tradition. At the same time, nevertheless, there are certain riwayat, certain traditions, which kind of allude to the fact that surgery specifically was something that was not approved of